This is Channel 2.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.
Welcome back to the Business Bunker Show here on Channel Radio in association with Biz Radio. You're listening to me, Paul Andrews, and the stonkingly gorgeous Jill Serkin.
And sadly, I didn't bring any stroop waffle in.
Did you not?
And I do love a stroop waffle. Especially dipped.
I can only apologise for her, but I need to apologise. Listen, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome back onto the Business Bunker Show Fleurtje Hooter, who is the Chief Executive Produced in Kent, one of the nicest ladies I know, and who is incredibly forgiving of my penchant for murdering the pronunciation of a beautiful name.
Luckily, you have a spit guard on your microphone.
And luckily, I have a spit guard on my microphone. Fleurtje, thank you so much for joining us, Fleurtje. I'm sorry about...
Thank you very much for having me.
No, it's always a pleasure to see you.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
We were talking kind of off-air that you actually took up your post as CEO in January 2020.
Yes.
Which was a great time to take up.
Yeah, little did I know.
Yeah. But you've done a fabulous job since then under very trying circumstances. But why don't you start off by telling us what the remit of Producing Kent is and what it is that you actually do?
Yeah, so Producing Kent is a membership organisation representing local independent food and drink businesses in Kent and Medway. We've been around for a long time, actually, since 2005. I was told that Producing Kent was actually set up after the whole foot and mouth disease episode, and was set up to support the agri sector and the producer sector, as they'd been badly hit, and also their reputation had
absolutely.
they needed support, and that's how Producing Kent came about. And we've been speaking on behalf of our members ever since. So we support businesses throughout the food and drink supply chain: growers, secondary producers, manufacturers, wholesale, retail, and hospitality. Large and small, predominantly producers, but businesses across the whole chain.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Kent has always been known as the Garden of England, and we've always been big fruit producers and cob nut producers and a few other things like that. But in recent years, of course, we've developed this whole stream of vineyards and producing wine, and then the whole microbrewery thing. And Kent was always a home of brewery and hop growing. We don't grow so many hops here now as we used to, but it's been interesting how that sector has really taken off even more in the last few years because of those developments into French beating wine growers.
French beating wine and French beating cheese as well. But let's talk about the wine.
The soil is, as I've been told, identical that we have here to the soil in the Champagne.
Yeah.
So with climate change, we are providing better and better conditions together with the soil to grow.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And we're winning big time.
Yeah, because I can't remember which of the French Champagne growers opened a vineyard here as well. Was it
Evermore?
I can't remember which. It was one of the big ones, like Veuve Clicquot or someone. But it's one of the big producers has acquired a vineyard in England, and they said exactly that. The
climate.
The climate and the chalky soil more than anything.
The terroir, as they would say. The terroir. That means the soil to you and me.
That's what I said.
Terroir.
That's what I said.
But Simpsons Might Wine, our friends as well, I was quaffing some of that the other day, and it's absolutely delicious, Simpsons Wine. Mm. You know, Ruth and... is it Ruth and Henry, is it? Not
yes.
Henry.
Yes.
But Ruth, anyway, she does all the work. That's a fabulous one. They also have a vineyard in France as well. Mm. And, of course, our friends at Squarries have got, and they've opened a really posh vineyard where you can go and taste and eat and the whole shebang there.
The whole thing, and, Hush Heath and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not just growing the wine. Most of them have opened their vineyards for tours. There's restaurants at Hush Heath. I did a tour. I don't drink, I'm teetotal, but I spent a lovely day at Hush Heath watching how they make wine.
And there's lots to learn about it. Most, if not all, have created lovely visitor experiences. And I think especially now people are going out again. And
exactly.
Starting to do things.
Absolutely.
And it's, we've seen a really growing interest from the public into local product and produce and wanting to know the story behind it.
So absolutely.
That ties beautifully into all of that.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's a major part of where we are now. People are much more interested in the origin of their food and how it's grown, how it's produced, and are much more in tune with, not everybody obviously, but a lot of people are still very keen on knowing about where their food comes from and how it was done, and whether it was, you know, in terms of animal type food, whether it's ethically produced or not.
But I also think during the lockdown, because people had to, especially in the first lockdown,
when there were shortages,
had to really look around locally,
using their local green grocers.
You weren't really allowed out.
Well, the supermarkets didn't cope, did they? They could not cope with deliveries. But the local shops could. So
yeah, and they picked up a lot of that. And I think going to your local shop more regularly and then talking to the owner and learning more about their business and who they're dealing with and who they're getting their product from really opened up a whole new world, I think, for people who have always seen those shops and might have bought the occasional item there as a little bit of a top-up, but now turn there far more regularly.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think many years ago there was a bit of a myth about local shops that they couldn't supplied a range of products that a supermarket could, and they were quite expensive because they didn't have the buying power of a supermarket. But that's changed. It's changed radically. My local shop, Dale's Place in St Michael's, is fabulous, and it is no more expensive than Tesco's or Sainsbury's or anywhere else, and it has a range of basic foods and basic products that you can buy, and not so basic, you know. And they've been fantastic. They have been absolutely fantastic. They're open like 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, so you can go there, you can shop. You know, they're open longer than the supermarket because it's smaller. They don't come under the rules of having to shut at some stupid time on a Sunday morning.
It's also how you buy, I think. When you buy local, or at least that's my experience and what I've heard from people we've spoken to, you don't need to buy in bulk like you do in a supermarket. You go there once a week, you fill your trolley.
Yeah.
But then you end up throwing
absolutely,
you know, a good part of that food away again because it's just more than you're actually going to eat. Whereas I think if you shop local, you choose much better what you're going to buy and use.
It's funny you should say that. And it's kind of one of those almost positive things that came out of the lockdown is that, like a lot of people at first, we were ordering online and having food delivered. But there were two things that would go wrong with that. Well, three. One, it was difficult getting delivery slots at reasonable times of day. Two, you're never quite sure what you were going to get because they substitute stuff. And three, it just, you know, you just sat there waiting for it to arrive. When we were kind of allowed out again, it was really nice to go to the shops because they were the only place you could go. So I stopped, you know, the way we started shopping was shopping locally two or three times a week. Back to how it used to be many years ago, and we found that although we were spending more money on food, we were actually eating it and not throwing it away.
Yeah, nose to tail is happening, isn't it, in Kent now? You know, the whole, if I go to, for example, the Good Shed, as we mentioned today, you know, you can buy the whole cow there. It's all nose to tail. Use it all, kidneys, liver, heart, so good for you. Mm. I mean, I'm a carnivore anyway, and I just think it's brilliant that you can now use that. But also, my local greengrocer, Staines Farm Shop in Whitstable High Street, I was trying to help him. So I said, well, I need a delivery for my mum, who's 90, and one for us. I said, bring it all to my house and then I'll take it to mum's. And he said, oh, no, Ben likes to deliver it to your mum to see how she's getting on. Now, would you get that from your supermarket?
Well, exactly.
No, you wouldn't.
And I really think that people have appreciated that. And they've seen how local shops, local retailers, local producers have really stepped up to the plate. So they saw how hard they were working to keep up and to offer a fantastic service and how personable it was.
And
I really think it's greatly improved people's experiences shopping. It's not just, oh, that you know, got to do shop.
It's a chat of how you are. And yeah, yeah. But also look at Kentish fruits. You know, our strawberries are renowned. You have a supermarket strawberry and then you have a Kentish strawberry. The difference when it's in season. Mm. And our plums, of course, are coming in now as well. It was Tattinger, by the way, the wine.
Yeah, I know it was one of the
I had to get
ones.
My cogs working.
Yeah.
But how amazing that Tattinger have opened up in Kent. It's great.
Absolutely.
And the apples, you know, our apples are renowned all around. Cider.
Lots. We've got such a varied landscape and countryside. I think that's why we have this plethora of lovely...
No, absolutely. So, as an organisation, Fergie, with Produced in Kent, do you have a feel for how many producers you have as members at the moment?
Not an exact number, but last year we looked and it's, I think 60% of our membership is producer.
Right, okay.
Yeah, big and small.
Okay. From a market point of view, how does that break down? I mean... are we still mostly a fruit and vegetable producing county, or is it across the board? You know, is there any glaring thing that, you know, dominates the market, or is it we're producing all kinds of stuff?
Well, Kent's renowned for its soft fruit and top fruit.
Of course.
You know, and we've got a number of larger members in that area.
Hmm.
But I think you see a bigger variety now of not just growers, but also secondary producers who come with their own products.
Mm.
And
that's
a really lovely thing to see.
Absolutely.
So we've got the chili jams and the marmalades. Beautiful jams we have here.
Yeah, but we've got chocolates. We've got, all sorts of lovely ambient products.
Mm. Yeah.
That are
marshmallows.
Ice cream. I mean, it is a range of everything, isn't it?
Let's not forget the rapeseed oil, which is really lovely.
But... also coming back to originally, you know, what Kent was famous for was its apples and things like that. You've got Brogdale Farm of Faversham that has strains, is that the right word? Types of apples that they keep.
Propagate.
Yeah, they do that as well. but basically old, ancient, what do you call them?
Varieties,
that's the word, thank you. Varieties of apple that they preserve from going, out of favour.
And the flavour of those cannot be beaten. It cannot be beaten.
Yeah. So, Producing Kent has this membership where you support all these producers and providers of food and drink. What are the kind of things you do to help that? How do you make that happen? How do you give them support, if you see what I mean?
So there's three areas, really. So we speak on their behalf. Mm. We do advocacy on their behalf. So we talk to local, regional government, and we are part of some national groups and platforms as well.
Okay.
So we discuss the challenges of the sector. And obviously last year there were many and still are many.
Absolutely,
so, we've been in regular conversation with Kent County Council, of course, who support us as well.
Right.
And we've got good contacts with Indefra, for example, so we've got regular conversations with them as well. So that,
So you've got this policy element where you influence policy and where you...
By giving intelligence and information about the sector that will influence policy making and decision making.
Okay.
Then we support our members through promotion and marketing.
Right.
So we have a website, we have newsletters, customer newsletters, two different ones that each come out twice a month.
Right.
So they kind of promote everything that our members are doing.
Mm.
And we have very active social media channels. So we push a lot of messaging out there as well. So we basically help amplify our members' marketing campaign. We can't set it up completely for them, but we will shout out whatever they give us to shout about.
Absolutely. Yes.
And we do our own campaigns, of course, about buying local produce. Last year we were very active with our Buy Local campaigns, Help Kent Buy Local.
Okay.
And that gained a lot of traction. And this year it's the Change One Thing campaign, which is our customer campaign. And it's all about, you know, if you can, we have to change our relationship with food. We have to make sure that we, by our consumption, we contribute to a sustainable future.
Sure.
So how can we change that relationship in a way that, you know, protects our environment, helps the local economy and preserves our countryside? So we come up with tips and we encourage the customer to send their top food hacks to us, and we share them on our website.
Oh, fantastic.
Social media channels. So, you know, how to deal with leftovers, how to deal more sensibly with food waste, how to buy more sensibly, etc.
It is incredible how much food we waste, isn't it, really?
It is quite incredible. Yeah. 6.5 million in the UK every year.
I know.
And 4.5 is edible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's even after what they call fair food, the people that distribute food from supermarkets that's going out of date.
And ugly fruit they do as well.
There's quite a few food sharing apps and organisations. Yeah. So there's Olio, which is a customer-to-customer model. So it's customers who are left over with or have surplus food or leftover food in their fridge. Can put it on the app, and then other people who have also access to the app can pick it up from their house. You've got Too Good To Go, which is a business to customer model, so it's retail and hospitality that have leftover food at the end of the day or end of the shift. They can offer them in magic bags to the customer can pick them up against a discounted price, so you can take part in that scheme if you're a business with a customer facing side.
Well, we came across on the show a couple of years ago an organisation called Toast, who go round at night and collect all the bread that's not been sold from bakeries and supermarkets and turn it into beer overnight.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
Which they then give away. It's a complete. They're a charity. They're not for profit organisation, and they make Toast beer.
Yeah.
So there's lots of things like that that happen.
Yeah, and so we have looked at that actually with Producing Kent and through our No Food Wasted forum, which we set up summer last year.
Right.
Because we saw there's a discrepancy really between the amount of food waste and surplus food that there is and then the growing number of people within Kent and Medway that are dependent on food handouts and actually don't really have access to fresh produce. So there's big demand for fresh product. So we set up this forum bringing together businesses, charities and community initiatives that are all active in that area of reducing surplus food, food waste and creating better access to good food for all.
Okay.
So we come together every 6 weeks to discuss what's going on, who's doing what, where we can work together, how we can avoid duplication of activities. And we also looked, can we come up with a concrete activity together? So we are now developing an app which is called Food Loop.
Right, okay.
And great name.
Food Loop, yeah. It's a business-to-business concept. So it is different from Olio and from Too Good To Go in that respect. It's connecting the suppliers of surplus food with the takers of surplus food. And they can be businesses, they can be community initiatives, they can be charities.
Right.
The app is basically functioning as a platform where the two parties come together.
Right, okay.
So a supplier of surplus food makes an account on the app and then puts a certain supply, say a crate of apples, on the app. And then on a taking side, whoever has indicated when they created their account that they're after apples will get a beep on their mobile phone saying that there's a crate of apples available at such and such place. You have to collect it within the next 36 hours.
Great idea.
And then they can go offline, they can contact each other, go offline and then strike a deal. Whether that's a sale or a donation, that's
up to them.
That's up to them. Yeah. We are not getting involved in that part at all.
Okay.
It's just connecting the two and making sure that food, surplus food, is kind of staying in the area so that it's not shipped around the country, which is often done.
Yeah, absolutely.
So reducing carbon footprint.
Yeah.
But it's also, kind of creating a local community for people who help each other. So it's very much, enhancing that sense of community.
And fantastic. And that's Food Loop, it's called?
Food Loop, yes.
And is it available now or is it still in development?
So we did a crowdfunding campaign, which actually finished beginning of this week, so yesterday. But people are still very welcome to donate, of course, towards the campaign. What we're going to do with the money, once we've got the money together, is develop the app fully and then run a 12-month pilot. So we're taking the app throughout the seasons to make sure that we include all seasonal produce. We're creating as big as possible community of suppliers and takers and then run the app throughout that period, take out all the glitches, making sure that it works and it serves a purpose and people are actually using it.
Sure. Yeah.
And then hopefully put it out to market.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic project, and I wish you much success with it. So that's Food Loop. You can still donate to it.
Yeah.
What platform is it on?
You can find information on our website, producingkent.co.uk. Okay. If you're interested in donating towards the campaign, then send us an email, info@producingkent.co.uk.
Fantastic. I'm sure people will do that. It sounds like a brilliant initiative.
Yeah, I just, sorry, I was tweeting, but do you involve restaurants as well that get no shows and they've got surplus foods?
Yeah,
so local restaurants can do that.
Of surplus food.
Brilliant, because that must be a headache, mustn't it? Do you never know how many covers you've got turning up?
But it's leaning more towards products than prepared meals, so to say.
Right.
So a restaurant that would look for an outlet of leftover prepared food, we would probably refer to Too Good To Go.
Yeah.
Because they are excellent in what they do. And so it's important to mention, actually, we have struck a strategic partnership with Too Good To Go because we see that we're complementary to one another.
Mm. Yeah.
So they will market Food Loop where they can and refer businesses to us where they think it's more relevant, and vice versa.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Now, you know, the problem that for hospitality providers at the moment, and we've seen this a few times now, haven't we, George, is where people book tables and then don't turn up
is disgusting.
It's just so bad. And, you know,
You've got 12 haunches of venison in or something, and then nobody comes.
Yeah, I mean, some things like meat, I mean, you could put it in the freezer, but fresh vegetables and stuff like that, you're just going to chuck it away. And that's just...
We've got a lovely potato. I was just thinking of Providence potatoes over in Manston. Great potatoes they grow. You know, we're so lucky here, aren't we?
They're a member
for everything. And fish, of course, great fish.
We've got it all.
Absolutely. You know, and it is one of the benefits of Kent and where we are strategically placed. As Freddie quite rightly says, natural geology of the county is such that it's conducive to growing stuff, but we're also surrounded on three sides by the sea, I don't know why, but we're also one of the biggest producers of cob nuts. I don't know why.
Alistair, he's on your, he must be on your list of people, members, Alistair.
Yeah,
cob nuts. Do you remember the cob nut jam we used to? Beautiful.
Cob nut jam.
He does one. But the chili jams are great as well. I'm addicted to chili.
So we're a great producing county, I'm a big fan of localism and community stuff. I think that's what works more than anything. You know, it's okay having these long global supply chains of doing stuff all over the world, but the reality is if you can walk around to your local shop, or you can go to your farm shop and buy stuff straight off the farm, and then why not? Why shouldn't you do that? So we love what you're doing. We wish you much success with Food Loop, and I'm sure it will be very successful, because it's one of those things that fills a gap, isn't it? That, you know, so many of us. I mean, I look in my fridge and I think, if I don't eat that, it's why I'm the size I am. If I don't eat that soon, I'm throwing it away. This is my excuse. I've got to eat that, otherwise I'm throwing it away, and I'm not throwing it away.
Anything can go in a soup. I put lettuce in a soup I've got a glut of it. And
dandelions.
Dandelions.
Dressed crab.
You should share your tips with the Change One Thing campaign.
Yeah, well, I do it's on my Twitter. You've seen me frying up old sort of carrots and things. I had a glut of carrots because we went camping and left carrots for the kids who were looking after the dog. And, of course, they didn't chop them or scrub them because they're organic, so they're a bit muddy because we've had rain. And so I had, like, a huge bag. And I just stir-fried them and, you know, did everything with them. It's so easy. But, you know, if I have leftover, I never ever throw it away. It's the way I was brought up, really. And I don't go by sell by dates either. My cleaner was horrified when she went through my cupboard. But, you know, tins of mackerel, tins of sardines, that's fine.
I think your nose is the best tool to see.
I do that. Amanda said to me the other day, there's a tin of tomato soup here. The sell by date was 2014. I went, it'd be fine.
It'll
be fine. Don't worry. I'll eat that. Don't worry. I'll have that. They found a tin of
corned
beef, wasn't it?
Oh, was it?
It was a tin of corned beef that was given to the troops during the First World War. And it didn't have a sell-by date on it, obviously, but it was canned 1916.
Excellent.
So they
is it in a museum?
No. They x-rayed it first because they said, we're not sure what to do about this. And they x-rayed it and they said, it actually looks all right, but we're never going to know unless we open it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and okay. So they opened it. They did it in a lab. It wasn't just in, you know, a cafe somewhere. And they tested it and they said, it's perfectly edible.
Yeah.
It is perfectly edible, and it's over 100 years since it was put in the can.
I even collect, you know, when we cook...
I wonder how it has changed in taste, though.
Yeah. It probably didn't taste very
nice. I would think it's fine. It's probably lost a bit of its pinkish colour, and it's probably lost a few nutrients, but it's probably edible,
yeah.
But I do, when I do a roast chicken, I do a roast chicken every week, and I use all of it, and I make a gut soup broth from it afterwards in a slow cooker. But I use the chicken fat, and then I fry my eggs in it and everything. Mm. So I use everything from that. And I think kids need to be taught that because, you know, this throwaway culture that we have is, and like, you know, like you say with bread, I don't really eat bread, but my new husband does. So I buy beautiful bread, sourdough and all that. But he can't eat a whole loaf, so I slice it, put some in the freezer, so he's just got like four slices to keep going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's how kids need to be taught.
I think our relationship to food has kind of been disconnected over the years, and we've moved more to, you know, it's part of the pace of life and all the rest of it. Now, I mean, I'm as bad as anyone. When we were still allowed out... you know, my lifestyle was so busy that, you know, most of the food I consumed was junk because, you know, you'd look up.
You're on the road.
You're on the road. You go, right, I need something to eat. There's a burger shop or a chicken shop or whatever. And you'd eat that because that was what was there. And we also, as far as I know, stopped teaching what in my day was called domestic science.
Yeah,
which is
same as me. Yeah, domestic
cooking
science.
Cooking in schools. We stopped doing that.
Mm.
And we lost that connection.
They took the kitchens out of schools, out of secondary schools.
But it's that losing that connection with food altogether as well, you know, the origins of food.
And the whole instant thing, isn't it? Because it's instant gratification. McDonald's, you know, where I live, you see the queues. They actually stop the whole roundabout in the morning where they're queuing to get a drive-through of McDonald's. And I feel like crying, you know.
I don't know how true it is. You know, a lot of the things you see on social media aren't necessarily true, but... I saw a funny thing the other day. A guy was saying he was in the car with his kids that were kind of 8 or 9, and they were driving past the field of cows, and he went, oh, look, steaks on the hoof. And all the kids looked at him and went, what do you mean? And they said, steaks on the hoof.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, Daddy, that's not a beef plant.
yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
And I'm not sure how true that is, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me because we don't talk about it anymore. We don't talk about the origins of food. We don't talk about where food comes from.
So this is where we really want to try and make a difference. And there's more of our members are very keen to actually, you know, step outside and talk about their business, their product, the provenance of it, the way they produce it, and how what they do to produce things sustainably as well.
Mm.
There's a lot of... there's a lot of new developments there.
Well, I think that's really good, and I think that's where an organisation like Producing Kent really steps up to the plate and engages people in terms of what we're doing. And it's at two levels, this, as well, isn't it? It's making people aware of how food is produced and what is produced here. So you've got the, you know, this, you know, this is an apple, this is how it grows, this is a chicken, this is how it, you know, whatever. But there's also the fact that these are businesses and they are important businesses.
Passionate people.
Yeah, but there are businesses that are important to the Kent economy and the UK economy.
Hugely.
Massively. And, you know, we talk a lot about food security these days. Mm. You know, as we've seen, just, you know, without getting into the politics of it, HGV deliveries have been hit by a shortage of lorry drivers.
Mm.
Now, there's a whole heap of different reasons why there's a shortage of lorry drivers, not least of which nobody's been doing HGV tests for the last year. But whatever, there's a whole heap of different reasons why we have a shortage of HGV drivers. And then all of a sudden, food isn't getting delivered to supermarkets in the same way. And, you know, you have these supply chain problems.
Mm.
But if we bought our food more locally a lot of the time, you overcome a lot of those problems.
Yeah.
Mm. So we, We do a monthly editorial now in Inside Kent, a regional
magazine.
Magazine, and that's called Meet a Producer. So that's exactly, you know, to show the business behind the product, and to also to listen to a personal story. People love storytelling.
Absolutely.
And this year's Taste of Kent Awards, which is the awards that Producing Kent organise every year.
Yep.
I've been to many.
I know you have, yeah.
With Farmer Charles Tassel.
So we issued the Taste of Kent magazine for the first time.
Right.
And we're going to keep that as part of our awards going forward.
Okay.
So that showcases all the finalists and winners.
Right.
So it's an annual, edition, once a year. And again, that also shows the story behind the finalists. And they're so passionate about, you know, what they do and what they produce and, and how they do it.
It's, absolutely.
It makes for great reading.
I absolutely. Really you know, and there's a lot of young people in the country that are aware of environmentalism and green credentials, and they think about it heavily. But there's a disconnect between them understanding environmentalism and understanding how food's produced.
Yeah.
And so the more we can fill that education gap, the better off we're going to be, I think. So I love the work that you're doing to do that. And I think it's an absolutely brilliant thing that you're doing. And especially here in Kent, because it is a major industry for us in Kent as well. So all power to you, Fergie, for doing that. Give us a shout out for your website again so people can come along, find out about all the things we've talked about.
Yeah, so it's www.producingkent.co.uk. We've got lots of information, all our members obviously profiled, but also an overview of events and food and drink festivals. We've got a vacancy page with all the vacancies that are going in the sector.
Fantastic.
At the moment.
Yep.
Now we've got a green food page with all the top tips about, you know, dealing with food more sensibly.
Right.
So that's going on from our campaign. So yeah, there's lots of stuff to find there.
And fantastic,
go and have a look.
Yeah, do have a look at that. We've put a link to that on the Kent Business Radio website. That link will stay there forever. So if you need to find it, you can find it there. For the moment, Fergie, thank you so much for sharing that with us again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And keep on keeping on what you're doing. And let's hope that 2021-22 starts to kind of come back to some form of normality. And we get out of where we were.
It's been interesting to see how restaurants have adapted and cafes to the al fresco, and how hard they've worked just to get tables outside. And of course, our weather isn't predictable, so it's really, really tough for them.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about kids, you know, the variety, the numbers of variety of apples we've got in Kent.
Yeah.
If you sat the kids down and just chopped up all the different ones that we have in Kent, it's amazing the flavour, the difference. I love it.
And then you've got people like Nim's Crisps making fruit crisps out of stuff.
And
I saw something she'd done. She's invented some air drying thing as well. I can't remember the details.
She's now supplying restaurants as well, so you know, for pre-dinner drinks and things like that.
Isn't she making stuff that you use to make other food or something? So it's not just the crisp now. She's making air-dried ingredients.
That can go with cocktails.
Yeah, that you can put in cocktails and shoes.
Edible tea.
Delicious.
Of different things.
Amazing. Amazing. Amazingly innovative.
And she was on Scoff and Quaff, must be 12 years ago, and she's just flown. It's lovely to see.
But that's the thing, you know, there's a lot of local small food and drink businesses that have, you know, in the past years grown to be really well recognised.
Yeah, large Kent Crisps,
company. Absolutely.
Of course. Kent Crisps, which we've eaten many, you
absolutely.
And
Oyster. I'm a big fan of Wonder Chup as well.
Yeah, Wonder Chup.
Yeah, they're great.
And what was
strong on sustainability as well.
Yeah,
they are, yeah. What was the other ketchup we had lately?
Must Chup. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a few, haven't we, as well?
Well, there's Benedon Sauce, you know, Sally, lovely Sally that makes Benedon Sauce and stuff like that. And one of the problems that those organisations have is how to take their kitchen table products and turn them into businesses when they get to a certain size. That's always a struggle, is moving from one to the other.
I mean, I know I talked on Scoff and Quaff about the expat as well. The expats over in Saudi Arabia and Dubai and that work, and they just love Kentish stuff, you know, marmalades and things like that.
I thought you were going to say Marmite.
No, marmalades. We've had a tweet from Paul Barber. You didn't read this, did you, or did you?
Don't think I did.
He says, good luck to our Produced in Kent CEO, Florgie, and all. I always love chatting with these lovely radio presenters, Paul Andrews and Jules Serkin. There is a picture of us scoffing. Again, it was many years ago, that, because we looked quite young.
Paul, you had
hair.
Loyal Producing Care member, and he's also one of our Food Loop champions. So we've got people who donate a certain amount to Food Loop become a Food Loop champion, so they get to use a specific logo. They of course are mentioned everywhere we talk about Food Loop, and they get to use the app for free for the rest of their life once it comes to market. And what we're also trying to do, just to come back to Food Loop, so once we've got the money together and we're ready to run a pilot, we're going to organise a dinner for all Food Loop champions.
Oh, wow.
The Gastronomist in Ashford.
Right.
Which is a new restaurant, fabulous restaurant.
What's it called?
The Gastronomist.
Nice.
They've recently
Good
opened.
Name.
They're really fantastic. They're all about local product, but very international haute cuisine. And they create this whole experience, so you really come there for a food experience. So we'll bring all the Food Loop champions around the table, and we're going to serve them a dinner made completely, entirely out of surplus food.
Oh, wow.
And
what a good idea.
Hopefully we'll start that discussion with this group on how to really cut down seriously on food waste in Kent and Midway.
Fantastic. Mm. Oh, what a fantastic
Sounds idea. Like there's going to be some drama there that I can imagine it's going to be very imaginative and sexy.
Well, you must tell us when that happens so that we can report
Absolutely.
On it at least.
Yes.
Yeah. Fred, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Do stay with us for the remaining part of the show. And we love Produced in Kent and what you guys are doing. It's fantastic stuff.
Thank you.
Nice one.
Thank you for your support.
I was just looking, Paul Andrews, Produced in Kent's timeline on Twitter. And yes, you can follow them, as we said, on Produced in Kent. And they have been, you know, I've been struggling after my AstraZeneca. Apparently, they say that they're, I've lost the tweet now, but they are finding a huge demand for this pine needle tea, which is supposed to help with COVID, but also post-COVID vaccine. And I'm still looking at the research of that. So they say quack COVID cures. We should put a question mark against that because we're not sure. UK tea supplier sees sales of pine needle tea rise by 5,000%.
Pine needle tea.
Well, there I am with my dandelion. I'm having homepathic remedies.
Then that's sticking.
It should be pine needles.
Yeah. Well, I've read. You know, we're looking at research on that. Me and Sally Beck. There's a journalist I'm working with, who's, as I said, researched vaccines for 25 years, and so we're looking into this pine needle tea. Yeah.
But mine boggles.
They'll steep it. Obviously, you're not going to have the prickles in your throat, Paul Andrews.
Are you not?
No. No.
Are you sure?
But I've got a Scottish pine tree in my garden.
Have you?
So, you know.
And you got a monkey puzzle as well.
No, I haven't got a monkey puzzle.
Have you not?
Have you got one?
No. I've got more trees than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah,
do you see what I did there?
You've got more squirrels than you can shake a stick at.
Don't start me on the squirrels, blooming things.
They can't be worse.
Oh, they're a nightmare.
He's got Mexican squirrels
in his garden. I've got Mexican squirrels in my garden. They wear little sombreros and stuff.
Yeah, and he bought a special bird feeder, Florgie, that squirrels could not access, apparently.
Took them an hour. Took them an hour before they got into it and emptied it. Yeah. They came mob-handed, 10 of them.
I've got a baby rat in the garden. And, of course, where there's one rat, there's another.
Yeah.
And I bought a humane rat trap. We've put whole earth peanut butter, which is all we had. almond butter, I think it was. But the minute I put the bird seed out, he trots out.
Yeah.
But we've got this humane one. So then I've got to, if we catch him,
You've
we
got to drive
him
5 miles away to let him out.
How many miles away are you?
I'm more than that. You're not coming over my place.
Come in your garden.
Yeah.
But, rats. I've noticed more rats. We never had a rat problem until lockdowns. And I wonder if it's because the restaurants were closed. And so they've had to come into gardens.
Yeah, probably.
Not sure. I'm not keen on rats.
No. What have you got?
Okay, so furlough changes. This is an interesting one. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. As of Sunday, the 1st of August, which was last Sunday, the amount that businesses which are making use of the furlough scheme will have to pay towards the wages of furloughed employees will rise to 20% from its current level of 10%. The government will contribute 60% of wage costs following the change, down from the current 70%. This level of employer and government contributions will remain in place until the end of September when the scheme closes for good. Do you happen to know, Paul Andrews, how many are still on the furlough scheme? How many people off the top of your head?
Yes, I do.
If not, you can tweet me.
2.1 million still on it. There's been 11 million people go through the furlough scheme since it was introduced.
Unbelievable. They're all on my beach, actually, most of them.
Exactly.
But why can they not, if we can go to football matches and theatre and pubs, why can't they work? What's the reason? Do we know?
Yeah, well, because businesses still aren't in a position, a lot of businesses still aren't in a position to properly open again and rehire, you know, people and all the rest of it. And I think, without trying to be too political, I mean, I think the government realised that the big thing that would happen if they just shut the economy was that everybody would be made redundant.
Yeah.
So the government would have been paying money anyway, you know, in terms of social security payments and dole money anyway.
Mm.
And I think they learnt a lesson from, I can't remember what the scheme was called. My German's not very good, but
nine.
Okay. Many years ago, the German government introduced a scheme whereby if you were going to make people redundant, they actually paid you to not make them redundant, which is basically what the furlough scheme is as well. And they introduced that as a general thing about 10 years ago, where you could get a government grant that paid half the wages as long as you kept them on. Without making them fully redundant.
Mm.
And that was quite successful because what it enabled businesses to do, businesses have cash flow issues and, you know, one of the biggest overheads is your staff costs.
Of course.
And so businesses that were struggling, their first instinct is to make people redundant. But, of course, once you get rid of people, you've then not got anybody to do the job and it's a downward spiral.
Mm.
So what they did is they introduced this scheme. I can't remember what it was called. It was some long German name. They introduced this scheme whereby they paid half the salary of someone. But what it enabled, it gave businesses a lifeline
to
stay in business.
Mm.
Yeah. But so not getting rid of people, and therefore they survived, and they found that more businesses survived that would have gone completely bust and got rid of everybody, and it enabled them to regrow again and stuff like that.
But it's also the mental health issues. If you're stuck at home without a job, it's okay, you can go to the beach, you can know, you can walk and do stuff, but eventually it gets really depressing and really boring being at home.
And I think that's the difference. The German scheme, which is pre-pandemic, it wasn't anything to do with the pandemic, because before that was people staying at work and getting paid by the government to work. The problem with the furlough thing is we've now spent 18 months paying people not to go to work.
To go to work.
And that's difficult. And I think the government realised that, you know, they've been kicking it into the long grass. So now, as of this month, they're only paying 60% and you have to make up the other 20%. And then the furlough scheme ends in September. There was some mutterings about extending it, but I don't think the chance is going to extend it. I think September is when it's going to end. So October is when
the clocks go back. But
October is when you will see the
kickback.
What happens from there and how many people are made redundant.
I've just put, we've got a lovely cleaner, and I've just put her money up because she works really, really hard. She's a veterinary assistant and she cleans for us and three other people.
Mm-hmm.
She's got three children, and the cost of school play in the school holidays is £20 a day for each child. So she's got three, that's 60 quid before she gets out of bed. And she says that the mums that don't work get it for free. So she says, where's my incentive to work?
Yeah.
It's really tough for her.
Yeah.
So we had a chat and I said, look, I'm going to put your money up. But there is no incentive. If it's free for childcare, you know, for these holiday play schemes, if you don't work, but then £20 if you do work, it's okay if you're raking in loads of money, but she's working really hard.
Yep.
That's another show.
All these things are really difficult, aren't they? Because it's always a balance. It's always a balance between, you know, helping people and then not hindering.
But where is the incentive to work if you've got to find 60 quid a day to get your kids while you go to work?
Yeah.
If you see what I mean, it's easier to stay at home.
Well, this has always been my big beef about the tax system is politicians use the tax system as a weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't use it effectively. Mm. There's lots of loopholes and schemes and scams for companies, which is where you get all this tax avoidance nonsense. Mm. Yeah, but they don't do things like for instance, just as a for instance, I know it's slightly different now because they've kind of decimated the economy anyway. But back in the day, back in the 1980s, when interest rates on mortgages were fluctuating all over the place.
Yeah, scary times.
We had a thing called MIRAS.
Yeah, I remember MIRAS.
Do you remember MIRAS? MIRAS was Mortgage Interest Relief at Source,
which
was a tax incentive, which is why the British got so obsessed with buying their own homes, because we had this tax advantage of actually buying your house where you got tax relief against the interest payments.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you rent... All very well, but what do you do when you retire if you haven't got enough in your pension to pay your rent?
But that's just a different argument. It's a valid argument, but it's different. But my point is that there was a tax incentive to buy a house.
To buy a house, yeah.
And that was taken away by Tony Blair. But what I'm saying is things like, you know, childcare and nursery places should be incentivised through the tax system, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
To help people... Yeah, stop
who
using,
want to work.
Yeah, to help people that want to work be able to work, you should be able to offset that against your income tax, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
That's how an effective tax system works, where you take money from the top and give it to the bottom.
Mm.
At the moment, what we do is we take money from the top and squander it on vainglorious projects like building a railway that no one's going to use and stuff like that.
Well, I see the buses now. We have a bus that goes by, double deckers, and they're going by empty.
Yeah.
And it just seems, of course, they've got to have public transport. But if people are working from home, they need to rethink these huge double deckers and how, you know, who they're taking. There's like one person on them.
Yeah.
Maybe they need to have little mini buses or something, because it's also the exhausts and things.
Yeah, well, they're trying to pilot electric buses, but again, a lot of that's coming home to roost. In Herne Bay, we have a hydrogen production plant, and Canterbury City Council are running a pilot scheme using hydrogen-powered buses.
Excellent. Yeah, we covered that, didn't we, a few weeks ago?
Interestingly, just for what it's worth, my belief is that electric vehicles aren't the future. They are not, certainly under current circumstances. I think we're more likely to have hydrogen. And I saw a really interesting thing about using argon gas.
Oh, wow. That's very space age.
Yeah, a university in the Midlands has pioneered argon gas as a mixture with hydrogen.
Hydrogen.
And what they're saying is it means that we don't have to change the infrastructure.
Mm.
You can do away with petrol and diesel and just fill the tanks with argon
exactly.
instead.
Exactly, and you don't need all the batteries.
Yeah,
and
it's a conversion on a petrol car that I think there's a long way to go with all of that, and there's lots of things happening. And just for what it's worth, just because I'm on a bit of a roll about this moment. Yeah, the government have just given permission in Nottingham to install, certainly the UK's first, and I think the world's first, commercial nuclear fusion plant.
I don't even know what that is. I thought it was something you'd put on your nails.
Yeah, yeah.
What's a nuclear fusion plant?
Well,
sounds horrible.
At the moment, nuclear power is fission-based, which is where you split the atoms apart.
Yeah.
Fusion is where you smash them together. And for a long, long time, scientists have postulated that fusion technology is cleaner, safer and greener even than fission, which is also clean and green and safe. But fusion technology is cheaper, much cheaper to do, if you could get it to work.
If it works, it's always a bonus.
Yeah, but, you know, this is, it's like any scientific
invention.
You have to work on it and make it work.
And is that in the Midlands, did you say, or up north?
It's in Nottingham.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and it's a company, let me get this right, called TACMAC. And TACMAC is the technology. I may have mispronounced that, but TACMAC is the technology, spherical TACMAC energy production step, where you produce a TACMAC is a device. It's a magnetic device that you build in a loop that causes plasma to stay within.
You've turned into some boffin overnight.
Well, I used to work in the nuclear industry back in the 70s. I worked for the company that built Three Mile Island.
Okay.
Combustion engineering. Built it for Westinghouse.
I always knew you were combusting.
Yeah. But in the United States and other places, they've been rolling out what are called SMRs, which are small modular reactors, which are much smaller nuclear reactors, but they're still... fission reactors, old style reactors.
Bring it on!
But again, you know, if you could make fusion a commercial reality, then electricity production goes to a completely different level, which may make, you know, electric vehicles much more viable.
Talking about shortages and things, as we were, and COVID, my mum is still waiting for her dishwasher.
Really?
12 weeks, she's told, but it's been... I mean, 12 weeks is a long time for a new dishwasher. Well,
what's holding it up then?
It's some little bearing because of COVID, some little thing. She's got... it's not integral, it's semi-integral, so... To replace it, I don't know. And I won't use Currys or anywhere. I don't know if they'd have been any quicker anyway. But the manufacturer, it's probably German or Swedish or Chinese maybe, has said it's a 12-week delay. So she's washing up by hand at the moment.
Oh, blimey.
Grumbling.
That's not good.
No.
She needs a mangle or something, doesn't she?
Yeah, to crush her china.
Crush your plates.
Yeah, they use mangles. Yeah. So it's been almost 30 years since the Isle of Sheppey last had a regular freight service. Did you know that?
Yeah.
To the continent. I'm quite excited by this. But now DFDS has launched one from Sheerness to Calais en France. Richard Goffin, who's the port director of Peel Ports, which runs Sheerness Docks, said we're bringing back the service after 3 decades of not having one. The daily service, which began last month, has created an estimated 100 jobs. That's brilliant. But I don't know if I'm allowed because I'm not double jabbed.
Well, you can't go on it anyway.
Oh, is it freight?
It's freight.
Oh, can't you box me up?
But not only is
it... Does it say freight there?
Yes, it is. Not only is it freight...
Oh, yeah.
But it's not a container and you can't take your lorry.
How does it work then?
What you do is you drive to the port with a trailer on the back of a lorry rig. Mm. They load the trailer onto the ferry, and then the other side, a different lorry, hooks it up and delivers it to the final destination.
That's very clever.
That's clever, isn't it?
But you could box me up and I could nip over.
I could stick you in a box.
Why
and put
don't
you on
they
there.
Do passenger?
Well, because it's a freight service.
Yeah, I know, but why don't they also do it?
Because,
you know,
sensible people go on the train through the tunnel, don't they?
Oh, yeah, you do that, don't you?
Yeah, well, when I was allowed.
Well, you now, you're double jabbed, you can go now.
No, you can't, you still can't go to France, can you?
My father-in-law's there in Monton.
You can't, yeah, but you have to
near
do...
Near Le Pen.
Yeah, but you have to do all this 14-day quarantine still.
Yeah, but you could quarantine over there with the cheese and
no,
all
but you've
that.
Got to quarantine when you come back as
well. You've got a nice house. It's not like you live in a high-rise.
Yeah, no, but that's not the point, is it? I need to work. I can't,
you can come in here on your own.
I can't visit my grandson for 3 days and then spend 28 days not going out, can I?
It's not easy.
Yeah.
Well, I know that my son, Josh, who's Ibiza Kitchen, IFF Kitchen in Manston, is also Ibiza. And he says life is normal in Ibiza.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they shut it down yesterday.
Did they?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't speak to him. He sounded very chirpy.
They busted an illegal rave and shut it down. Anyway, we've reached the end of the show.
God, where did that go?
Yeah, I know. And so thank you for that. Thank you for our fantastic guest,